everyone, and welcome back to the ICU Ed and Toddcast, ICU Ed Like Education, Ed and Todd, Toddcast Podcast. I am Eddie, he is Todd, and today we're going to talk about extubation. While intubation is, for the most part, the more exciting and adrenaline-pumping part of the process, being good at extubation, or liberating patients from the ventilator, as it's referred to in the literature, is probably the more impactful on our patients' long-term outcomes.
Hopefully, if you think about it, every patient who we intubate, we plan to successfully extubate, not terminally extubate, but successfully extubate. We had this discussion at our institution during COVID when we wanted to celebrate extubations, and administration came to me and said, we should celebrate extubations. And I said, wait a minute. When I intubate a patient, extubation is the expectation. Like, I'm expecting to get the patient off the ventilator. That was very clear to me that while intubation is the exciting procedure and what we do, extubation is really part of the innovation when we're innovating people.
Yeah, so I didn't hear about that. So they're trying to like have like a bell like they do for like cancer, like,
right?
Those infusion clinics.
Like play a song every time we extubated a COVID patient or something. And I was like, wait, I think the goal is to extubate all of these COVID patients.
What are your, I think, general thoughts on extubations or any stories from your recent stint on service?
Well, I think people have heard me say this. All of the data that we have, and this leads into the studies that we're going to talk about a little bit today, but all of the data that we have about breathing trials and criteria to get into breathing trials were done before some of our newer technology. So, and before some of our newer data. So they were done before, for example, we had data about extubating to respiratory support like non-invasive ventilation. And they clearly were done before we ever had high flow nasal cannula devices and the ability to deliver oxygen through a high flow nasal cannula device. When I was training, I was taught the reason that we have these cutoffs for where we're going to start to do an SPT is because this is where we're comfortable that we can provide that level of oxygen without a tube down your throat. And I think that's changed with high flow nasal cannula and maybe with non-invasive, but especially with high flow nasal cannula, I think we can provide higher levels of oxygen without a tube down your throat. And it makes me always wonder, and this is why I really like the first trial we're going to talk about. It makes me wonder if we should reevaluate our criteria for who should we try an SPT and who's eligible for an SPT.
Yeah, and I've heard you say that multiple times, and so I try my best not to think of you when I'm not physically in your presence. But when I saw this article, the first thing I thought of was you, because the first article we're going to be talking about is effective aggressive versus conservative screening and confirmatory tests on time to extubation among patients at a low intermediate risk. It was published by Martinez et al. In Intensive Care Medicine of March or February of 2024 in the past couple of months.
Let me tell a little entree here, because this is also part of this. And you've probably heard this also, but I think it's instructive for the listeners. Our ICU actually has a protocolized breathing trial and weaning criteria. And so the patients are put on a breathing trial if they meet certain criteria by our respiratory therapists, essentially with a standing physician order, but not an individual physician order for each patient. And you've been up there enough now that I'm sure this has happened to you. And it happens to me at least once, if not multiple times when I'm on service. Well, the RT will come to me and say, hey, Mr. Smith, I met the criteria and I put him on a breathing trial. And I'll go, Mr. Smith, that's pretty funny. There's no way Mr. Smith is like going to pass a breathing trial, right? Like, I mean, he looks awful and that sort of thing.
And then they prove that you, prove you wrong.
And then two hours later, they come and they go, Mr. Smith looks good. What do you want to do with him? Right. And the answer to that is almost always, well, I guess we're going to extubate Mr. Smith. And Mr. Smith, the vast majority of the time, does quite well because he's passed his breathing trial and he gets extubated. And it just really, really, really draws questions in my mind about us, the clinician, being the gatekeeper for when are you ready to try and show us whether or not you can come off the ventilator. And we've made it so that we're not really the gatekeeper, but we are because we have these criteria that are set. And if you don't meet the criteria, you don't get an SPT. Maybe our criteria need to be revised or at least reexamined.
Yeah. I mean, this is where I wanted to guide this opening segment anyway, was just talking about like how aggressive you are with extubation, right? So we have these criteria for screening for SBT. We have this criteria for what SBT is and what does it mean to pass. What I've heard in the past, I think from you, is, well, about 10% of your patients are going to end up being reintubated. And the corollary to that is, well, if you're not reintubating 10% of your patients, then are you being aggressive enough?
And we'll talk about this later on when we get to the results of this trial. That 10% is kind of an arbitrary number. That's sort of what is happening in our ICU. And we say, well, that's just the number. But we don't know what the right number for that is. Is maybe the right number is 20%, or maybe the right number should be 5%.
Yeah, this is balancing that risk of reintubation versus the risks of staying intubated in positive pressure ventilation that we don't really know. This is the number that's kind of that's quoted in trials, but this is the number that we kind of like we're trying to improve too, right?
And then the other thing that you'll hear is lots of people will say, yeah, but if you look at the data, if you reintubate somebody, they have a worse outcome than if you don't reintubate them. These are not randomized data. We're not randomizing patients to being reintubated or not. What it tells you is that if the patient is sicker and needs to get reintubated, they do worse than if they are successfully extubated and don't need to get reintubated. It's sort of a no duh that they do worse. It's not clear to me that they do worse because we reintubated them, that that's in the causative pathway. I think it's a marker of the fact that they're not doing as well as the patient who doesn't need to be reintubated.
Yeah, no, I think this first 5 minutes of this podcast has gone over the two things that I say all the time. Well, sicker patients are sicker. And also, well, we don't do a good job of predicting things as clinicians. So this is a good place to start. I will say though, over the past year or so, I've tried to intentionally be a lot more aggressive with my breathing trials and extubation and pulling the tube. One of the things I say to patients and their families all the time is, well, you know, being aggressive makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable, right? Because I've been used to this one practice pattern my entire training. But I'd say to patients and patients' families, I wouldn't offer this if I didn't think it would work. But if I'm wrong, then you're in the right place for us to do something in case something happens. And I found trying to be really aggressive, I still haven't been reintubating a lot of my patients.
Well, I think from our patient standpoint, and I think this is probably true from our respiratory therapist standpoint, and I think it may even extend into our house staff teams and our physician and APP care teams, I think we view reintubation as a failure. And I'm not sure that frame, that mind frame is necessarily correct. We view that as a failure, but we don't view being on the ventilator for two extra days as a failure. And I think that's the risks and benefits that you're balancing.
It's because it's slapping you in the face, right? If someone stays reintubated.
I don't know what you do during your reintubations, but I don't get slapped in the face during mine.
Sometimes I underdose my paralytic. If someone gets reintubated, it's like you failed, right? Like it's just like a very discrete event that says, hey, you didn't do a good job, or that's what it seems to say. As opposed to if you just keep them on the ventilator for a little bit longer, they stay, quote, quiet on the ventilator. Or maybe they develop a complication of being on the ventilator and you say, oh, wow, I'm so glad I kept them on the ventilator because they're getting sicker now, when actually maybe they wouldn't have gotten it before. It's the lack of that discrete event that I think makes us feel worse when people
get ventilated. I completely get it. I'm just wondering if that mind frame is not correct, we should work on – I mean, we're not going to change that mind frame because – as you said, every time you reintubate, you get slapped in the face. But
not if you dose your paralytic right.
Yeah, you gotta make sure it goes into the IV.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting
concept.
That's
also assuming it's the patient slapping me in the face. Sometimes the respiratory therapy slaps me in the face. Sometimes the nurse slaps me in the face.
Sometimes you slap yourself in the face.
You can't paralyze everybody. No specific programming reminders today. Just the good old like, subscribe, 5-star review plea that I should say every episode, but sometimes I forget about. We've gotten some feedback that we should have some deeper discussions on AI or artificial intelligence in medical research, which is fair. I think we probably need to get a guest on to do that since I'm not an expert and Todd definitely is.
Maybe we could invite ChatGPT to talk about itself.
Oh, that would be fascinating, but probably be a bad episode. But the next time there's a related article, we'll do that. And then related to listener feedback, but a completely different end of the spectrum, some of our listeners, and this has happened sporadically throughout the run of our podcast so far, have suggested that we should do fake ads for fake medical products. Something we might try. You got a big smile on your face, Todd. If you have any ideas or suggestions, let us know. ICU at edandtoddcast@gmail.com or at ICUcast on X and Twitter. We'll obviously come up with some of our own, but your suggestions will be better than what me and Todd come up with. I think this is going to be hard if we do this. I'm not sure it will stick.
Oh, I mean, but you could have the ICU Ed and Toddcast sponsored by BMS Systems.
I was thinking more like just completely fake products, like abnormal saline. Normal saline wasn't the answer. Oh, maybe abnormal saline is the answer, right?
Yeah, nice.
I don't know. We'll see. We'll go with our first article, which I already introduced, and we'll start with the acronym. The acronym here is Speed Up. And spoiler alert, this isn't an acronym. I found it on clinicaltrials.gov. Speed Up comes from speeding the weaning up, aggressive screening criteria in higher minimal ventilatory settings. So I get where that comes from. Speed speeding the weaning up, speed up. I understand what they're trying to do. I'm not super thrilled. What are your thoughts, Todd?
you're sub super thrilled. It's nice. I think the short phrase, because like you said, it's not an acronym. The short phrase describes the study actually pretty well, the hypothesis of the study or what they're attempting to do. So it gets some regard for that, but it's not an acronym and it doesn't go with the title or it doesn't go with any of the words in the title. And so for me, it's someplace in the sort of probably 4 or 4.5 range.
I agree. I was going to give it a 5. What I've been doing in my head is that I've kind of allocate 5 points for the acronym, like how good an acronym is, and 5 points for like how nice of a short title, how easy it is to remember what the trial is. And so I think putting those together, you're probably pretty low on the acronym scale, fairly high on the how easy it is to remember what this trial is about scale. And I end up somewhere in the 5 to 6 range.
Is it like the SAT where you get 200 points just for writing your name?
You got 200 points for writing your name?
Yeah, I got 200. They told me that was because I wrote my name.
We talked a little bit about extubation and being aggressive. I did like how the authors here broke down the process of weaning from the ventilator, which I think is important to talk about first. First is the screening process, so to see who should you start on the SBT. And the second is the testing process, so the actual SBT to see if the patient would do okay spontaneously breathing. So in broad strokes, this trial was looking at challenging the criteria to screen for an SBT and challenging the settings that you would perform SBT on.
Yeah, I don't think they actually say this in the trial, but it's really a factorial design of those two hypotheses and those two questions. Because they're closely related, they kind of combine them into just four arms. But really, they could have drawn a 2x2 box and said this is a factorial design trial.
Yeah. So really quickly for listeners, what do you mean by factorial design?
Well, factorial design just means you're testing two different questions and you do it in one trial across a population. And so you essentially have a 2x2 grid and patients are randomized to one of the arms, A or B, and then they're randomized to the other arm, C or D, and then you get, you know, a box that's A+C and B+C and A+D and B+D.
I thought you were going to get confused there. I was waiting for it. No, but you did a good job.
Well, we did have to do 14 takes on it, but we finally got it.
I will say off the jump that one of the reasons we delayed in talking about this one, because this is an article that Todd's been very interested in for a while, is because it can get a little bit confusing, and they're going to talk about aggressive, quote-unquote, and conservative, quote-unquote, strategies for screening and for SBTs. So we're going to step through them slowly when we get to that point.
Yeah, their language is a little confusing, right? They have aggressive, conservative. And conservative aggressive, and you're like, wait a minute, what is going on here?
Yeah, so I think it's temporal, right? So the first word is going to be the screening and then the testing. When I step through it, I'm going to add the screening and SBT language to make it a little bit more clear. But this was a difficult trial to process, I think, on the first pass. Speed up was performed in 8 ICUs in Spain, and the patients were adults who were ventilated for at least a day, had at least 50% FiO2 and 10 of PEEP, and they had to be, quote, not high risk, which again was a little bit confusing. And they list two sets of criteria for not high risk. The first set was like eligibility, quote unquote, which was defined as 3 or less of the following risk factors: age greater than 65, heart failure as the primary reason for intubation, moderate to severe COPD, or more than 2 comorbidities.
I was just going to hop in really quickly.
Yeah.
Do we know why they excluded high risk patients? Do they think we know the answer for how we're supposed to do high-risk patients?
I wonder if it was a regulatory issue, potentially.
Maybe. Or, and you'll get to this, when they go to extubate patients, they use a sort of extubation procedure that I probably wouldn't use in high-risk patients, and maybe that's why they excluded high-risk patients, was to treat them all the same during extubation. I don't know. I couldn't find it in the manuscript why they excluded those, but I thought it was interesting because I think, to me at least, this question is also pertinent in high-risk patients at high risk for reintubation.
And you would also think that just from taking the ethics and regulatory part out of it, that from a trial design perspective, that is probably where you're going to get the most bang for your buck, right? If you're
potentially
based off your outcomes and having a higher effect size and whatnot.
Yeah, potentially. Although you could imagine, depending on what your view is, we've kind of given our bias here at the beginning, but if your view is that that if you're at high risk, you absolutely should be more conservative, they may think that there's not an that aggressive in the high risk group isn't going to do anything other than put those patients at increased risk and not have much potential benefit.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. We say the high risk group is just is just going to be re-intubated and have worse outcomes no matter what you do there. Yeah. Let me finish reading that high risk part. So I talked about like the baseline characteristics, which would make someone high risk just at a baseline. And so that's your eligibility criteria. The inclusion criteria was you had to have three or less of a separate list, where the first part was the entire prior list. Your Apache score, Apache 2 score had to be less than 13 on extubation day. If you're having difficulty with secretions, you have airway patency concerns, you had a failure of your first SBT, which I thought was a little bit odd, or being ventilated for 7 days or more, which I also thought was a little bit odd, and we can get into that.
I think those are in previous publications, characteristics that have defined patients that are at high risk for reintubation, for failing extubation, essentially.
Yeah. But I think we can talk about this now. The reason I found those last two odd was because the intervention potentially could impact you failing your SBT. So if you had a more conservative settings for your SBT, or you had more conservative settings for your screening, then you'd be on the ventilator for longer. You might cross that 7-day threshold, or you might fail your first SBT and then be excluded. And so it feels like it might be stacking the deck a little bit against the aggressive sides.
Yeah, agreed. You're implicitly commenting that you're worried that some of these exclusions may not be equal or similar across the different arms of the trial.
Yeah, and that's my concern. It doesn't bear out in their consort diagram. So my guess is that just I'm misunderstanding the words here, and that there's not an issue, but it is something that I thought about as I was reading.
Or, I mean, occasionally, we don't like to admit it, but as trialists, occasionally we do get lucky. We set ourselves up for something bad to happen and it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's fair. But the inclusion in screening criteria for me summarized to, you've got to have a pretty healthy patient at a baseline who's on the lower end of the critical illness spectrum. I think that's the summary there.
I think that's fair.
You've mentioned the extubation protocol. Do you want to go into that, Todd? Do you want to go over that really quickly?
As I think a trial like this should, they have a protocolized procedure for doing the actual SBT, and then they also protocolized how to extubate these patients. And I think when you're looking at something that they can't blind, I mean, this is going to be really hard to blind. And so it's open label. And
can you imagine trying to blind that? We'll talk about it in a second.
I mean, they'd have to like just obscure the FiO2 and the PEEP, so that you didn't actually know what your patient was on.
I would freely and gladly unblind myself if you put a piece of paper.
And that point's well taken too. It'd be pretty easy to unblind yourself if you wanted to.
You could break the screen. I mean,
yeah, perfect. So they have protocolized ways of doing this, which I think is the right way to do it, because then it takes a little bit of the subjectivity out in this open label unblinded trial. And so what they did was they did 30-minute SBTs, and they made all of their SBTs 30 minutes, so they reduced the confounding for how tolerant patients were for their SBTs. And then at the end of that 30 minutes, they drew a blood gas, and they excluded patients, they said, with hypercapnia, although I don't know if that's an exclusion from extubation or an exclusion from kind of the trial going forward. Then, interestingly, they actually reconnected their patients back to mechanical ventilation for an hour. And I think we've talked a little bit about reconnection back to the mechanical ventilator, but there are now two studies, neither of them, I think, large enough and definitive enough to say this absolutely should be part of your practice, but two studies that suggest that if you reconnect somebody after they pass their SBT to full support mechanical ventilation for an hour prior to extubating them, that they tend to have fewer reintubations. And it's sort of a fascinating concept that I think people are still trying to understand what the mechanism may be and why it may work if it works. But they did that in all of their patients for up to 60 minutes of rest. And then they set up preventative therapy for the extubation, which was essentially high flow nasal cannula. And they extubated patients to high flow nasal cannula.
Yeah. I thought the ABG and the hypercapnia part of it on the SBT was a little bit odd, because I was waiting for the next sentence to be, and we extubated those patients non-invasive, which is what the data suggests.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
And we don't, like, just to be honest, do you do that typically in your practice? I don't.
So let's be explicitly clear.
I don't know, right? Because I don't check
if
that ABG.
I know a patient has hypercapnia, because many of them have it at baseline, right? And so we know that they have it. I will extubate them to non-invasive. I do not, in every single one of my patients, get an ABG on their SBT to see if they have hypercapnia on their SBT. And then if they do, extubate those patients to non-invasive.
Yeah. I think that every once in a while we'll have a case where they'll get a blood gas for some reason on SBT, they'll be hypercapping. They say, well, they're not ready, and they put them back on a rate. And only when I come back around in the early afternoon and say, hey, why isn't this guy extubated?
The other thing in our practice that makes this a little bit nuanced and or complex, I guess, is that we draw a lot of venous blood gases. And if you're a little hypercapnic on a venous blood gas, what does that mean?
Oh, don't get me started, Todd. You know my bias there.
Just trying to poke the bear a little bit.
Some listeners at our institution will laugh because they know my bias against venous blood gases. Let's talk about their intervention here. So those are their protocols. So as Todd mentioned, this was effectively a 2x2 factorial intervention. Again, you could be aggressive or conservative for screening for SBT, which they call the weaning protocol, or you could be aggressive and conservative in your SBT protocol. So we'll take those one at a time. The screening criteria first. Aggressive screening was a P to F of greater than 180 on a PEEP of 10 and FiO2 of 50%. I think since FiO2 is fixed there, that just means a PaO2 of 90, right?
90 or higher, yeah.
Yeah, 90 or higher. The conservative screening was a P to F of 150 on a PEEP of 8 and FiO2 of 40%. And again, translating that P to F ratio for a fixed FiO2, that's a PO2 of 60. That was a little bit weird to me. So on the one hand, the settings were more aggressive in the aggressive screening arm, but the threshold was higher. It makes me wonder if you took the patient in one group and put them in the other group settings, they would pass or didn't pass no matter what your screening criteria was, right?
Yeah, I blow through the PDFs on these because when we do screening at our institution for SBTs, we never look at a PDF ratio.
Yeah, but
we look at are you saturating okay on a certain level of FiO2?
But a fixed FiO2 gives you a PDF ratio that's just a PaO2, which you can translate in your head to saturation.
Right. But I think, and this is, I think, what you were saying, for me, 50% FiO2. I just want you to saturate okay on that. I don't need a PaO2 above 90.
Yeah, because 90 is going to give you a sat in the 97, 98, 99%
100,
range.
100, 100, 100? Yeah, right.
Yeah, as opposed to PaO2 of 60, which is going to be in the 90% range.
Correct.
So you're conservative both in your screening settings, but you're more aggressive in your actual cutoff, which just was a weird combination for me to wrap my head around. At first, I was like, am I thinking this wrong?
Because you usually are.
Yeah, yeah. So I got in the practice of questioning myself, and I was like, well, no, actually, sitting down and thinking about it for an hour, I think I got that right.
That only took you an hour, huh?
Maybe like 50 minutes.
That was an hour well spent.
So I thought that was a little bit odd. Let's talk about their SBT protocols. The aggressive SBT protocol was 8/5 pressure support, and the conservative protocol was 5/0 pressure support. This is where I think we get a little bit into what practice variation is across the country, across the globe. At our institution, Todd, we do 5/5 pressure support. So it's a little bit in the middle, but way closer to the aggressive SBT protocol.
Well, and I think the literature kind of has started, Wes Ely's initial study of this allowed 8 of pressure support. So I think the sort of aggressive protocol that they have is sort of what, or at least as you said, is very close to what is in the literature as the SBT protocols. Yeah, I was unfortunately disappointed with these criteria only from the standpoint of, as we put out at the front, I want to be more aggressive in who I'm trying to extubate. And this was sort of the Todd thinks this might be too conservative to now we're going to even be more conservative as the two arms here.
Well, but we don't, I mean, this might be, we don't know clearly, but this might be more aggressive for these Spanish ICUs. They
agree.
They might be 5/0 as they're kind of normal.
Agreed.
And so this is aggressive for them. But for us, for you and I, and this is why it's important to kind of dive deep into these methods, we're a lot closer to the aggressive arm of this. And so for us, the intervention looks like it's aggressive screening versus conservative SBT. The primary outcome was time to extubation, defined as time from randomization to extubation, and randomization occurred within 8 hours of reaching the eligibility criteria. This is, I'd already alluded to it, the eligibility criteria was met based off of baseline characteristics. And so it gave me a little bit of pause when they were talking about their inclusion and exclusions, but I won't rehash that here.
But I think I think from a trial perspective, you have to do time zero as randomization, right? If you did time zero was the time to meet your SBT criteria,
yes,
it would be different in the different arms. And then you wouldn't really know how it affected overall duration of mechanical ventilation and who got extubated sooner versus the other arm.
Yeah. They also had a co-primary outcome of the they called it something different, but was the percentage of patients who tolerated their first SBT, and then they had a key secondary outcome of reintubation rate. And so those were their primary and secondary outcomes, I think, of primary interest. They had exploratory outcomes of ICU length of stay and hospital length of stay.
Yeah, they called that simple weaning.
Yeah.
Which was essentially you passed your first SBT.
Yeah.
First try at your SBT, you passed.
Any other methods pieces that you wanted to go over before we jump into the results?
No, I think this is going to take the listener a little bit of time in the manuscript to understand, because their methods are pretty complex. And while we've tried to break them down and make them simpler, I don't think it's really that easy to make these methods that simple. The concept, I think, is pretty simple to explain, right? It's aggressive, both criteria to start your SBT versus conservative criteria to start your SBT. And then once you meet the criteria, whether you're in the aggressive or the conservative arms to start the SBT, then there's two different ways of doing the SBT, one of which is an aggressive, more aggressive SBT, i.e. we're providing more support during the SBT. The other is more conservative, which means that you are having to do more of the work, and we're providing less support during the SBT. And, you know, and then as we talked about, they kind of combine those two questions across four different treatment groups.
Yeah. So this, like I said, this is a complicated one. We've repeated ourselves several times here, but really that's just because it just reflects the level of effort that we've had to kind of use to piece this trial together in our minds. From the results, patients were enrolled from March of 2021 to March of 2023. 884 patients were randomized. At the interim analysis, there was a 20% reintubation rate in the aggressive screening and aggressive SBT arm. So randomization to that group was stopped. Table 1 is baseline characteristics, about 40% male, the median age of 60. The maximum FiO2 and PEEP were 60% and 12. Any comments on stopping randomization to one group or the baseline characteristics?
Yeah, I understand why they stopped the randomization to that group. I think it complicates interpretation of the results some, because what ends up happening now is that we're comparing the groups, the four groups, and one of them
is half the enrollment of the rest.
And there was a temporal change, and they comment on this in the manuscript. And if you look at Table 1, you see that means that their aggressive group, aggressive screening, aggressive SBT group is 50% COVID.
Yeah.
And the others are 25 to 30% COVID. And while I've written sometimes that I'm not sure COVID patients are that different, I do think they were different enough, like in their duration of mechanical ventilation and, you know, how we extubated them and that sort of stuff.
Duration of acute hypoxic respiratory failure.
Right. I think that severity. That could have a play then in trying to compare the outcomes across those groups.
Yeah. And no, I think that's a really valid point. That was the only thing I was going to bring up, that 2021, 2023 was COVID, and COVID changed over time during that time period.
I will say, from a baseline demographic standpoint, I was happy to see that for the most part, the central tendency is that all of these patients were eligible and enrolled prior to meeting their SBT criteria. Because I think if a large proportion of the patients met the SBT criteria on enrollment, then you could say, well, they didn't get to these patients fast enough. They should have enrolled them even sooner to try and get the best bang for their buck and the different strategies for SBT and passing the SBT.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. This was a positive trial. The median time to extubation was 3 days in the conservative screening, conservative SBT group, 2 days in the conservative screening, aggressive SBT group, which is the group that we think that our practice is probably closer to, 1 day in the aggressive screening in the conservative SBT group, and for what it's worth, it was also 1 day in the aggressive group. In their secondary outcomes, the reintubation rate did not differ between the groups. 13.3% in the conservative screening, conservative SBT group, 16.1% in the conservative screening aggressive SBT group, 14.6% in the aggressive screening conservative SBT group, and 20% in the aggressive group, as we had talked about before.
Yeah, I know that p-value isn't significant, but if you look at that, it almost looks like there's a dose response effect there, in that the conservative is the lowest, the aggressive conservative, so doing the conservative SBT criteria, not the eligibility for an SBT, but the actual criteria, the actual SBT methods that were being done during the SBT, and then conservative aggressive, and then aggressive aggressive. And so I do wonder if, you know, that's a real signal, if there actually are more intubations when you're aggressive in one or both of the arms compared to conservative. And then we'll talk here in a little bit about how much importance we should place on that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. Just the taking the raw numbers at what they are. So they tried to take a group of low to intermediate risk patients, and all of their reintubation rates were higher than the 10% that we're talking about. So I found a little bit odd there. Just at least not odd, but like different from what I see, different from my practice. So I think that's one step there. The other question that I had is, it was a positive trial when you put the statistical test over all four groups. But as we talked about before, the conservative group, which was 3 days and the lowest reintubation rate, is not what I was considering going to, right? So we are more closer to the conservative aggressive group. And so I wonder if you just did a pairwise comparison, if this would truly be a positive trial.
Yeah. So I think that's fair.
So for us, so at least being a little bit more kind of self-centered here, for me in my practice, I wanted a pairwise comparison between the conservative SP screening and aggressive SPT group, which is closer to my practice, and the aggressive, right, which would be the only step up from there. And just looking at the raw numbers, I'm not sure you would find a difference if you just did a pairwise comparison.
Yeah, I think that's fair, especially given the fact that there's less than 200 patients in a group here,
yeah,
or just at 200 mm-hmm. patients in a group here. The other thing I'll comment on is the primary endpoint of timed extubation is a little bit problematic, because while I understand why they used it, it's not entirely all that we want to know about. Like, I can pull a tube on anybody, right? But if I have to put it back in, that is potentially a problem.
But that should be captured in your reintubation. That's why I presented them together.
Right? No, I completely agree. But I wonder if the metric, and we would have had to probably come up with it and define it, but I wonder if the metric was truly time to successful extubation. And then in that situation, the patient who gets extubated, reintubated, and extubated 2 days later, all of that counts, not just to the first extubation. And that patient is then penalized in timed extubation by the fact that they were reintubated.
Yeah. This is a topic which I actually do really wonder what other people's practices are, which group they fall closer to for screening and SPT. So, I mean, email us, reach out on Twitter X, icuedandtoddcast@gmail.com, and icucast, and share insights.
Let's go into the other outcomes, which I think are important here. They're secondary, but they're important here, yeah, which are ICU length of stay and hospital length of stay. Because those, I think, will penalize you if you get reintubated, essentially, right? Because you're
sure,
potentially at least, staying in the ICU longer and or staying in the hospital longer because we had to reintubate you. And in those, again, they essentially favor the aggressive group. And when I look at that as a sum of all of the outcomes, I then go, well, the one...
One thing to jump in there. That's lower hospital length of stay, ICU length of stay, in a higher percentage of COVID patients, which we know those patients had longer hospital length of stay. So this is, I mean, it's quite impressive,
right,
actually.
Right. So you would have said if that aggressive group would have had longer stay, you would have said, yeah, because they were COVID patients. They all stayed longer.
Yeah, but now that's,
right? That's what I expect.
But now that is surprising to me,
yeah,
because no matter what you're talking about, the populations of those groups are different now. More COVID patients, I would have predicted that it'd be longer, but it ended up being shorter. It's a little bit weird.
Yeah. So I think these results are fascinating, and I think thinking through them is important and trying to understand them is important. So we talked about ICU length of stay. We talked about hospital length of stay, and a factor in those, and a factor I think overall in the care of our patients, is mortality. And while it's not statistically significantly different, there are slightly numerically different mortalities in the groups. And in fact, the differentiation appears to be the screening process. The conservative screening, whether it was conservative screening and aggressive SPT or conservative, has about a high six and a half to 7% mortality rate. And the aggressive screening, even the aggressive conservative, has a 9 to 10% mortality rate. Again, not statistically different, but might be clinically truly meaningful if you had a larger study and continued to see that sort of difference. So if you take that, then as an overall summary of outcomes, you have faster weaning, faster time to extubation, quicker time to extubation, but more reintubations. And you have shorter ICU and hospital length of stay, but potentially slightly higher mortality. You know, I think these are really hard to know what to do with in clinical practice. Mortality obviously is a hard outcome. We don't want higher mortality, but I'm not sure that these are really different. And if they're not, And aggressive screening and aggressive SBTs result in patients coming off the ventilator faster with a slightly increased risk of them having to go back on the ventilator. But overall, gets our patients out of the ICU faster and out of the hospital faster. Then it makes me say maybe a 20% reintubation rate isn't necessarily wrong. That's just the cost of doing business, and that's the cost of trying to be aggressive to get our patients weaned off the ventilator and improved.
So this is saying that on the whole, patients will do better if I apply that practice, right? So not for each individual patient, right? We think that's potentially a backslide.
But even factoring in the, as you just said, backslide patients, we still had shorter ICU length of stay and hospital length of stay. So, you know, as you said, kind of overall for all of my patients, the best outcomes, if I care about ICU and hospital length of stay, are from using an aggressive strategy to try and get them off the ventilator. And that aggressive strategy will result in a few more, as unfortunately we've termed and everybody terms, failures, where we have to reintubate. But, you know, as my mentor always used to say, that's the cost of doing business. And that's the business that we're in, is trying to get patients better, faster, and out of our ICUs and out of the hospital faster. And so, you know, we take that risk because ultimately that's what's best for our patients in general.
Yeah. So I hear you advocating for that. Is this something you're going to do? Is this data strong enough to make you want to screen more aggressively, I think, effectively?
Yeah, I think I probably will push it a little bit. But as you said, we sort of already do the aggressive SBT part of this. And so I'm not exactly sure that I have supporting data to say, hey, we should be even more aggressive with our SBTs. But I do think it suggests that maybe pushing that envelope a little bit to being a little bit more aggressive might be beneficial in the overall for our patients.
Yeah. And I think just to be clear here, your conclusion and takeaway from the trial is completely different from the author's stated conclusion, right?
Right. That's, I mean, pretty typical for me.
Usually
because I'm just wrong, but maybe that's not the case here.
I think that if anything, this, again, I think I have to come back to, I don't feel like I see 15, 20% reintubation rates. No, there's some degree of like, oh, I come off service, and so the patients that I extubate in the last 2 days, I won't see get reintubated, and so on and so forth. And I feel like this data, if it's, you say, the biggest harm that we believe is the reintubation rate, and I don't see that, then I just, all I see is the benefit of decreasing their hospital length of stay, decreasing their time on the ventilator. So I think this would keep me on this train of trying to be a little bit more aggressive.
Normally you do this to me, but I'm going to do it to you.
Oh, great.
I'm going to explicitly read the conclusion because okay. I don't think we've explicitly read it, right?
Yeah.
The conclusion of the abstract says, among patients at low or intermediate risk for extubation failure with planned high-flow nasal cannula, combining aggressive screening with preventative PEEP and a conservative spontaneous breathing trial reduced the time to extubation without increasing the reintubation rate. So they're declaring the aggressive conservative group the winner in this. You've already said that we don't do the conservative SBT.
Right.
Are you going to move to the conservative SBT based off of these data?
No, because if one of the biggest pluses there is that the reintubation rate is lower, and I don't see a 16% reintubation rate, which is what they're comparing to, I don't have a reason to kind of switch to that.
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it. I'm just trying to think through, you know, as I said, I was excited about this trial because I think in today's age, with advances that we've made in understanding post-extubation respiratory support and with things like high-flow nasal cannula technology and devices like that in practice now, I think we need to reevaluate who we're evaluating for extubation and whether our criteria are still valid. So I was excited to see this topic in this trial. But as I go through it, as I said, I think their aggressive is more like I practice and their conservative is sort of more like the intervention here, even though that's not what they were intending to do. And therefore, for me, I'm like you, the aggressive here for me doesn't look awful. And in fact, has shorter length of stay. I guess it's not technically shorter than aggressive conservative, but I just can't see myself going to a conservative SBT because the other part of that, of course, is that while they stopped the aggressive early for reintubation, I'm not sure that that rate is a rate that I think is troublesome when the other outcomes suggest that it might not be.
Yeah. And I think I want to be clear to listeners here too. I'm not suggesting that I don't reintubate patients, but if we're going to compare apples to apples, like I've certainly had patients come back like a week or two later with a completely different process and need to be intubated again. Like, yeah, that's a very reasonable thing, but that patient wouldn't be counted in this outcome either. So just using that number and using that definition, 20% just high. And then I'm also throwing into the patients that I think are high risk extubations that we ended up pulling the tube to. So
the other thing I'll say from a methodology standpoint is that they stopped this trial because they thought the reintubation rate of 20% was too high. No, I shouldn't say stop the trial. Sorry, that's not fair. Stopped an arm of the trial because they thought the 20% reintubation rate was too high. Yet their conclusion that the aggressive conservative was better actually has the numerically highest mortality rate. It's not statistically significantly different. Neither was the reintubation rate, by the way, based off of the stats that they did.
Yeah.
It's just a little odd for me, to be honest.
Yeah. No, I definitely want to applaud the authors in tackling this question. This is clearly a question that Todd's had, and as just by proxy that I've had for a while. I've been trying to adjust my practice in the absence of data before this, and now with this data, it is really informative. This was a really tough trial to do, and I mean, this is great. This is great data.
Oh, absolutely. And it's still exciting to me because people are doing these trials, right? These are things that I think could change trials, that I think could change practice, and information that we need to know. And there are things I would do differently. I would have different criteria. Yeah. I would be more aggressive.
Yeah. Why don't we go there? Name a couple of things that you would do differently if you were doing this based now that we have this data.
Right.
Right.
For me, I would be even more aggressive with the criteria. So instead of 50% in 8 of PEEP or 50% in 10 of PEEP that they used, I would push that to 60%.
So that's just being clear. You're going to try to argue to some regulatory body that we have existing data, which stopped early because the aggressive was harmful. And you're going to say, I'm going to be more aggressive.
Right? Well, you're going to say it was harmful. I'm going to say it resulted in us identifying 20% of the patients that were probably not quite ready to be extubated. And so we had to put them back in the ventilator and extubate them at a later time. But it also identified 80% of the patients that were ready to be extubated and could be extubated sooner in the overall schema of things. I'm going to push that envelope. I'm going to push it to not 100% FiO2, but I think 60, I still wonder about 60% FiO2 and 10 of PEEP as my criteria. So that's one. The second part of this
let me stop you on your one. I have thought about this too. Your patients on 60% of 10 of PEEP generally aren't tolerating on being on pressure support. Like, they have some sort of existing lung damage, pneumonia, shunting, or something that they're just like not doing well.
Yeah, right? But that's not an argument against me having that be the criteria for an SPT.
I just feel like you're
they fail their SPT. I'm not extubating them if they fail their SPT.
That's what I'm saying. I feel like you're not going to see a difference using such aggressive.
But the question criteria to you is, do you think there are some patients that are on 60% in 10 that would pass an SPT? And if they did, you could extubate them and get them off.
That's very fair. My answer to that question is, I don't know.
So you know, I always say on rounds, people say to me, well, we didn't do an SPT because the patient isn't very awake. I don't care if the patient's awake. Like, if they're so sedated that they don't take deep tidal volumes, they're going to fail their SPT, in which case I'm not extubating them anyway.
You can breathe when you're asleep.
If they pass their SPT and they're not awake, now I have to go in and decide, are they awake enough, or is there something I can do to make them awake? Because from a respiratory standpoint, they might be ready to be extubated.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted you. What was the other thing you would
do? No, so then the second thing I'd do is that I would be more aggressive in my post-extubation respiratory support. In these patients, they didn't get non-invasive ventilation as far as I can tell, and it explicitly says that rescue was not allowed if they were failing their extubation. Now, we do have data that in some patients rescue may be bad, so I don't think I would rescue all of those patients. But in patients like COPD patients with hypercapnia who fail an extubation, we also have data that rescue in those patients may actually rescue them and result in them not being reintubated. So I would be more aggressive in extubating patients to non-invasive ventilation if I thought they needed it. And in patients that have hypercapnic respiratory failure, especially COPD patients that are failing extubation, to allow a rescue with non-invasive ventilation.
So you're effectively arguing that, and again, I don't know the answer to this question, that extubating someone to continuous positive, non-invasive positive pressure ventilation might be better than invasive continuous positive pressure ventilation. That's one of the things that you're arguing there implicitly.
Correct. And I think we have some data that that's true.
Maybe.
There are studies that look at non-invasive ventilation to expedite weaning criteria. And in general, patients tend to do well or better when they're extubated sooner to non-invasive than kept on a ventilator and extubated to not for a longer period of time and then extubated to not non-invasive ventilation. I don't, and maybe you think differently. And if you do, hopefully you won't be on any regulatory bodies anytime soon. But I don't think that we know that that is such a crazy idea that we can say, you know, that's just crazy, crazy. And we shouldn't let somebody try that to see if that's better for our patients. So while I had a different necessarily take on this than the authors, and the implementation into my practice is nuanced by based off of how my practice is, I'm still excited that this was done. And I'm excited that let's be honest, there are methodological things I would have changed, but I don't think they're wrong. I think they're just differences in what they chose to do and what I would have chosen to do in this. And I think overall, the quality of this study is actually quite high. And, you know, I think it's an area of research that we need to explore to better understand what's the right thing for our patients.
Yeah, I think what I hope is that this is kind of starts the cascade of more research in this area. Just someone had to rip off the Band-Aid, right?
Yeah, this is the two sticks for the Boy Scouts. Starts a spark.
Second article time. Listeners know the drill. A little bit of a shorter recap to be used as a jumping off point to discussion. We're going to stay in the extubation space and talk about extubation on pressors. This is liberation from invasive mechanical ventilation with continued receipt of vasopressor infusion. It was published by Zarabian et al. In the Blue Journal, May of 2022. I think, Todd, why don't you give the background on this one?
Well, I don't know all of the background, but the background for me was sitting in a faculty room at ESICM and talking with folks and just about things in general. And the practice of extubation came up, and suddenly people said, wait, do you extubate patients that are on pressors? And everybody in the faculty room, for the most part, was being asked this question, and it was all over the map. Like, well, I mean, there's not all over the map. There's, I guess, two answers, yes and no.
It was all over Europe.
Yeah. There was about a 50-50 split in the room as to whether or not you would extubate somebody who was still on pressors. The two rationales were, first rationale was, no, I won't extubate somebody on pressors because in the original studies done looking at SBTs, that was an exclusion to get into your SBT. Those patients weren't even tried. And so, you know, I'm not extubating those patients. Two, my practice at the time, and it's still my practice, is that I will extubate patients who are on pressors as long as I'm comfortable they're not high-dose pressors and they're not new in the previous 24 hours and they're not going up. They're not getting worse. If they're new or getting worse, then I say, maybe this patient has a problem that I don't really have under control or a new problem that I need to get under control. And that's probably not a person I want to necessarily aggressively extubate. But if they're coming down and they're low, this is a patient that is getting better. And frankly, at least in my anecdotal experience, patients that are on a little bit of sedative and ventilated, even if they wake up and interact with you, still may be a little bit of a lower blood pressure than they would be if you extubated them.
This is the vasoplegia from sedation. This is the decreased venous return from positive pressure ventilation.
Right.
So you might be on a low-dose pressure just from those.
Right. And in many of those patients, the most effective weaning practice is taking the endotracheal tube out.
Yeah, weaning pressors is to take the nutriotope.
Correct.
Yes, yes. You mentioned not high-dose pressors. This article will define their high-dose. What do you define high-dose as?
I think their definition's fine. Their definition is 0.1 micrograms of norepi per kg per minute. So for my – and I don't use a 70-kilo patient because those don't happen in our environment very much. I use a 100-kilo patient. So for a 100-kilo patient, that's 10.
Yeah.
So single-digit norepinephrine – mics per minute, not mics per kilo per minute. Mics per minute for me is probably low dose.
Yeah, that's fair. This is a retrospective cohort study of adults in Calgary ICUs who received both vasopressors while on the ventilator and had an extubation attempt in the same ICU stay. The comparators were those who were receiving vasopressors during the extubation versus not. The primary outcome here was reintubation at 96 hours, and secondary outcomes included mortality and length of stay. 11.7% of the 6,140 patients identified had extubation while on vasopressors. The primary outcome of reintubation was not significant, a hazard ratio of 1.81 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.91 to 3.61, p-value of 0.09. So not significant, but a trend towards harm.
Yeah, you go, you see, p-value is not less than 0.05, but I go, this one makes me a little nervous.
If it was Bayesian, you know. Let me finish out the rest of the outcomes. I think it's important to tell the story. Mortality was increased in this group, a hazard ratio of 1.22 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.02 to 1.47, p-value of 0.03. when you stratified extubation on higher versus lower dose pressors, which we said was 0.1 mics per kg per minute, if you had a higher dose pressor, there was increased mortality compared to no pressors, a hazard ratio of 2.25, confidence interval from 1.01 to 4.98, p-value 0.046. Okay, that makes sense. My gut reaction is sicker patients are sicker. I've said that already on this podcast. And sicker patients have worse outcomes. Yada, yada, why am I reading this? Well, extubation on low-dose pressors is associated with a lower mortality. A hazard ratio of 0.69, confidence interval from 0.51 to 0.91, p-value 0.01. And that was compared to those who were weaned off vasopressors. So that's interesting. What do you have to add there, Todd?
I think there's something we have to talk about in the inclusion-exclusion that is potentially pertinent. And that is that in this is a retrospective cohort. So they're limited a little bit in what they can do. But they exclude patients who died before an extubation attempt happened. And I'm worried a little bit that there might be some bias here. If I'm a doctor, for example, who won't extubate you on pressors, and you're on pressors, and I keep you on the vent for 3 or 4 more days, and then you die, as opposed to you're the doctor who extubated that patient on the pressors, and then you extubated them, and they went 3 or 4 more days, and they died, you're in the mortality for extubated on pressors, but you're not in my cohort for not extubated on off pressors. And so I worry a little bit about some potential bias being introduced by the fact that they excluded patients if they didn't have an attempt at extubation. Because if I'm hanging around waiting on you to come off pressors and I never attempt to extubate you and you die, then you're not in my cohort.
Yeah, that's fair.
So I think there's that part of it. But overall, I think these data suggest that it's probably safe to extubate our patients on low-dose pressors. I'm not entirely convinced that it's beneficial for them, like we're reducing mortality. Maybe. But I think it's probably safe. And I think these data are great data if somebody said, I want to rigorously study this in an RCT. And what I would do in the RCT is I would take patients on low-dose pressors that passed their breathing trial and randomize them to extubating them at that point or waiting until they come off of their pressors to extubate them and see what the mortality is and see what the duration of ICU stay is and see who gets reintubated and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, no, I think one of the things we were talking about, these retrospective observational cohort studies, is that in randomized trials, we assume that the two groups are even. And these retrospective cohort studies, a lot of the times, either intentionally or unintentionally, the deck can be stacked against one of the groups. And here the deck is stacked against the vasopressor group, right? So you're taking any patient who was on vasopressors and mechanical ventilation at the same time. One group came off of vasopressors and one group is still on them. It's not too far of a stretch to say that group on vasopressors, the 11%, that one cohort is a sicker group. So I think to find any positive benefit there is impressive, not just like a neutral result.
So I think the point is well taken. And in fact, I think if you look at time of duration of first invasive mechanical ventilation, you'll see that it's significantly shorter for the vasopressor group, which I think is good. If it was the same for those groups, then they'd really have a problem. One of the groups would have gotten better by 3.5 days and the other group still wasn't better. And those are definitely different. Here, you at least have the pressor group got extubated earlier, suggesting that maybe they're similar to the non-pressor group, which took an extra day and a half. It's 1.8 days in the pressor group of initial mechanical ventilation duration versus 3.5 or 3.8, I guess, in the no pressor group. But I agree with you. I think that, you know, the no pressor group for sure got better because they came off pressors. You had to be on pressors to get into the cohort. They came off pressors, so that part at least improved. The low dose vasopressor group, in my practice, I said, you know, they're kind of improving and it's coming down, but they're still on pressors. We don't even know that in this. We just know they're still on pressors. And so we don't know how much or if they've improved in that group. And as you said, I think they're likely to be sicker patients in general than the patients that are in the extubated once pressors were off group.
Yeah, and you could always make the argument that there are some patients in that group that aren't that sick, right? So you've had patients who weren't on pressors, got intubated, or on a low dose of norepinephrine, 2 to 5 mics per minute, and then they just stay on that and they're ready to be extubated. And as soon as they get extubated, they're off their pressors. I mean, that's related to positive pressure in the chest, venous return, so on and so forth. But I think as a whole, that group is probably sicker.
Yeah, sure. That group is going to have those patients, but it's also going to have patients that have kind of a smoldering septic shock and just needed a low dose pressors and are at risk for an exacerbation of that condition.
Do you have any recommendation to providers who have any dose of vasopressors as exclusion written into their SPT protocol?
I mean, I think based off of the data that we have available, that's not an unreasonable practice.
Do you think if you were in that category and this is what you were comfortable with, do you think you need to see a randomized trial to change? Now, this is, of course, your bias is that you're not that person, but...
Yeah, I mean, that's hard for me. I've already kind of changed without a randomized trial.
Yeah.
But, I mean, maybe if you're really, really concerned about the safety of that and you know, using these data that they can say, look, 1.8 for an odds ratio or a hazard ratio, while it's not statistically significant, in a larger cohort and a more precise point estimate of that, you know, that didn't go to 0.9 and 3, that would mean an 80% increase in mortality in the group with pressors.
I think that's re-intubation.
Oh, re-intubation. Yeah, because there was already a statistically significant higher mortality. So you could say the outcomes do look worse in this group. Now, you and I say, yeah, but that might be a different population.
This is interesting. This has come up now twice in this conversation, in this episode, the link between reintubation and mortality a third time. Overall, the data suggests that patients who get reintubated do worse. That might be a sicker patients or sicker thing. But now in kind of both of these, we see like, oh, more reintubation, but potentially lower mortality. I don't know. It's just an interesting thought.
Well, in the low dose, not in the high dose group. Yeah. 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 No, I mean, I think we probably, I think it just suggests that reintubation is probably not causative to the higher mortality that we're seeing in observational studies where reintubation is associated with higher mortality. I think it's probably a marker that the patient's sicker, not doing as well. And as you like to say, it turns out sicker patients that aren't doing as well have higher mortality than patients that aren't as sick and are doing better.
That's a lot longer than what I say. I say sicker patients are sicker.
This is a true story. I once had a consulting physician tell me that their patients actually in our ICU did better when we got them extubated than when we didn't get them extubated, which I thought was fascinating insight. So, you know, the patient that gets better and I can extubate does better than the patient who I never get better and never am able to extubate.
That's fair. It's not a false statement.
It was true. When you pulled the data, it was true. Yeah. I mean, I think this trial and the other trial, the speed up trial, are both fun for me to talk about because, as I've said before, I think we need to spend some time thinking about what criteria do we use to let our patients be eligible for extubation and then to extubate our patients. Because as we started this in a little bit of a discussion that I think you were laughing about, but it's true. When we intubate patients, our expectation is that we're going to extubate them. And so I think we should think about our extubation strategies are part of our intubation strategies. And I think we have lots of opportunity to optimize our weaning and our extubation strategies that will improve the outcomes of our mechanically ventilated critically ill patients.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think even if you don't think of them together as the same thing, but just to replace this emphasis on extubation, I think is the right way to put it. That's all we have for this episode of the ICU Edmonton Podcast. If you have any questions for Todd or myself or anything you want us to talk about in the future, you can hit us up at the ICU Edmonton Podcast @gmail.com. You can hit us up on the social at ICUcast. That's at Ed Chan, that's EDQIAN, and at Todd Rice _ICU. Send us your fake advertisements for fake medical devices. Send us your SBT screening and SBT practices. Thank you, Todd. Thank you, and congratulations to all the authors. Thank you to Mike Gannon for the intro and outro music. Thank you again to everyone listening. We will see you next time. Let's go save some lives.
Let's go wean some patients off the ventilator.
This podcast is made for educational purposes. The content provided in this podcast and in any linked material is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. It's inevitable, but we try to stay away from opinions, but all opinions represent our own and not of any entity that we work at. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy the podcast.